You know, tariffs have got to be the biggest exception to the issues and ideas rule, where we really don't stay on one topic too frequently. But in this case, considering the wide-ranging impact of Trump and his, as I call them, his tariff whims du jour, how can we not look at this topic frequently? In this past week alone, brought with it an avalanche of tariff actions, court responses, and rulings. Joining us to recap all of this is senior economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Ryan Young. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
CEI.org, the website. We have it on our homepage as well. You'll learn more about. Well, there's an interesting report that Ryan and a few others with Competitive Enterprise Institute have put together that make an attempt at sanity in the tariff idea. But let's just do a recap from this past week, Ryan, because we saw a court decision or a couple of court decisions regarding tariffs, intentions stated by the administration, and I guess we can call a pause on those initial court rulings. So take us back to what unfolded, I guess, starting with the Court of International Trade, which I'm guessing a lot of people were pretty much unfamiliar with until now.
Yeah, it's part of the judicial branch as outlined in Article 3 of the Constitution. But yeah, on Tuesday, we released that paper, and then on Wednesday, courts handed down a decision essentially nullifying President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs. So at CEI, we get results.
Yeah, this is true. And it's not a mystery. I mean, if you just look at, I mean, how much more blatant does it have to be with Article 1, Section 3, Clause 1? It's called the General Welfare Clause, or Clause 3, the Commerce Clause. It specifically states that all trade, including tariffs and anything connected to creating funding for the nation, begins and ends in Congress. So why has Congress become the wimpy kid that after the bully beats him up to get the lunch money, lets him come back the next day and steal his sneakers?
Well, that's part of a trend that goes back to practically the beginning of the country, where the executive branch has become more and more powerful with each successive administration at the other branch's expense. And that's one reason why these cases are so refreshing. It's really not about tariffs or trade or taxes. It's about the separation of powers. And if our country was founded on one idea, it's this: don't put too much power in one place. That is exactly what's happened with these tariffs. We're talking about the largest tax increase in 30 years since Clinton's 1993 income tax increase, and Congress didn't have any say in that. That is not how our country is set up, and it's good that the courts are calling them on it. There are two courts left as far as appeals go, so we're a bit out from a final decision from the Supreme Court, but that's on its way at some point soon. But really, this case is pretty airtight. The emergency that the president declared is not an emergency, and the bill that he cited doesn't even mention tariffs. And if you're going to have the largest tax increase in 30 years, the legislation you invoke should at least mention tariffs, which it does not.
You mentioned how the president declared an emergency. And I think a lot of people recall and can maybe more easily connect the emergency with immigration. That's how his reasoning for levying tariffs against Mexico and Canada, taking them off, put it back on. We know we've gone through that dance before. But how does the emergency foundation that he's operating with bring the EU into play?
It really shouldn't. And you know, those tariffs that he invoked on immigration grounds, that actually uses a separate piece of legislation. There are about four or five in play that the president has used. Those invoked a different bill from the 1960s involving national security. That'll be its own separate court case. This one, the emergency the president invoked for his Liberation Day tariffs, was trade deficits. And there's nothing exceptional about them. Every economist knows that trade deficits neither help nor hurt the economy. It's a value-for-value trade, and you add it up to a national level. Well, it's great that accountants do that, but we've run a trade deficit every year for 50 years. Per capita income has tripled. U.S. manufacturing output has more than doubled since the 1970s. We're better off by any imaginable measure. Unemployment is low. Incomes are up. So it's not an emergency, and the bill doesn't even mention tariffs. So as far as I'm concerned, this case is pretty cut and dry. We'll see what the courts say, though.
I was just going to say, logical minds assume because of what the foundation of our separation of powers is all about, but this might be a what if, but, you know, what calamity could happen if the Supreme Court rules in favor of what Trump is doing? And basically ignoring those separation of powers.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I hope we don't get to find out. One thing that's reassuring is that this Court of International has three appointees. The decision is unanimous. One of those appointees not only was a Trump appointee, but he formerly worked for Robert Lighthizer, a former trade advisor of President Trump's, who was very much a pro-tariff protectionist. And that tells you that the judge, who probably is ideologically sympathetic to tariffs and to trade protectionism, still ruled against the administration because America is a country founded on the separation of powers.
Is there anything? I mean, I was thinking back, was it 1971 when Nixon instituted tariffs on imports? But the difference is it was under the statute known as the Trading with the Enemies Act and was targeted at China. It was a 10% tariff on limited products. Does that serve as any precedent that the Trump administration can try to operate off of or make an argument with?
Not in this case, but yeah, it is something that they remain in their pocket. But the reason the administration likes the 1977 Emergency Powers Bill here is because it's quick. Under those national security tariffs or under this Nixon-era law, it can take months to get a tariff passed. You have to do studies ahead of time. You have to justify some kind of national security or treaty violation or other justification. And the administration is not patient enough to want to go through those. They did it before with those steel tariffs that are still in effect. But this time they want to be able to have a little more discretion in how they set rates. And, of course, we've seen how the economy has responded to that.
Starting with Ryan Young, Senior Economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. By and large, though, if you look at the core of what tariffs were designed to do, they're supposed to be a financial trade negotiating tool, not a weapon. Was there ever any inclination in past presidencies, past governments, Congress or the White House to weaponize tariffs at this level?
Yeah, it's been done twice. Once during the Great Depression with those Smoot-Hawley tariffs, if you remember from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That was a disaster. It took the Great Depression and made it even worse. And then there was one in the 1828 that turned out it backfired so badly it became known as the Tariff of Abominations. So we've tried it before. We know it doesn't work. And I think it's time to try a different strategy for a lot of the policy goals that the administration has in common with everyone else, regardless of their views on tariffs.
Which brings us to your aforementioned recent report, Trade Under Blockade, Navigating a Global Trade War, which you co-wrote with Kent Lastman and Ian Murray. What was it that you wanted to show as a foundation and a path forward in this report?
Well, the main argument is, well, one, separation of powers, which is, you know, brilliant timing on our part.
Yes.
But also the fact that America was founded as the world's largest free trading zone at the time. And this was on purpose because the founders knew that free trade and economic freedom are the ways to generate progress, freedom, prosperity, and everything good about America. There's a reason why America is so exceptional. It's because we were founded as a free trading, free market nation.
And certainly when you think of any kind of policy, I mean, take it out of government because it makes it more believable now, but a policy in a business needs to have a beginning, a middle, an end, a direction, a focus, and a purpose. And in this case with tariffs, it seems like all three of those are lacking.
Yeah, it's not clear what the administration wants. One day they say they want to raise revenue. Another, they say they want to block imports in order to, say, boost manufacturing. Well, if you're blocking imports, you're not raising revenue. So you can have one or the other. Can't have both. And then there's talk about trade deficits and fentanyl and immigration and this and that and the other. And so many of these competing objectives contradict each other, or they might have different rates that are appropriate for each objective, and it's incoherent. And if you're one of our trading partners, look at it from their point of view. How do you negotiate when you have no idea what your partner wants? You can't.
And thinking, well, not super long term, but at least for achieving the goal, which I think most people would be in favor of, about increasing domestic production, if you don't have it in your hand, how are you going to give it out to the consumer, the chain of distribution? So where's the logic of angering those who can help you maintain the supply chain as you work to increase domestic production, as opposed to shutting off and building, you know, isolationism, at least in trade aspects of things, and go without for what some people say could be up to a decade before you navigate everything from taxes and employment to environmental laws and several points in between. And in the meantime, you've shut down any access you have of anyone in any country that can help you cover while you develop that domestic production.
That's a really good point. Yeah, about 60% of what we import isn't consumer goods. It's not cheap plastic stuff you find at Walmart or Dollar General. It's inputs, components, machines that American businesses use to make American goods in America with American workers. It's been a political trope for so long about the decline of manufacturing in America, and people just take it for granted that nobody makes anything more anymore, that nobody bothers to look at the data. American manufacturing output, how much stuff do we make, reached its all-time record high ever in 2018, right before President Trump enacted his first term tariffs. It took a hit from that, as economists predicted, got a double whammy because COVID hit after that, bounced back a little bit, and then this year is just going to be a disaster because of those tariffs. If it wasn't for those tariffs, American manufacturing would be setting new records right now, not in some hazy, nostalgic 1950s.
And when you think, too, about demand increasing because of access to a lot of stuff, if you cut down that a lot of stuff to less stuff, the economy is not going to be receiving benefits from that as that unfolds either. Check out the report. We'll put a link up on our homepage to Trade Under Blockade, Navigating a Global Trade War, co-written by my guest Ryan Young, along with Ian Murray and Kent Lastman from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can also certainly visit CEI.org. Get some great insight with facts and reality in this and other issues. He's senior economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan Young, Ryan, thanks for the clarity you bring to what can be confusing, if only because of the rapid pace that unfolds. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.